Well, I think by now at least we know that this section is about the high priesthood of Christ. I'd like to ask someone to read the first six verses of chapter 8. First six verses. So, volunteers are Rick. Thank you.
Now, the main point is what has been said is this. We have such a high priest who has taken his seat at the right hand of the throne of the majesty of the heavens, a minister in the sanctuary in the true tabernacle, which the Lord pitched, not man. For every high priest is appointed to offer both gifts and sacrifices. Hence, it is necessary that this high priest also has something to offer. Now, if he were on earth, he would not be a priest at all, since there are those who offer the gifts according to the law, who serve a copy and a shadow of heavenly things, just as Moses, warned by God when he was about to erect the tabernacle, for see, he says that you make all things according to which the pattern which was shown to you on the mountain. But now he has obtained a more excellent ministry, by as much as he is also the mediator of a better covenant, which has been enacted on better promises.
If you were to capitalize the point that he had made in the previous chapter, how would you describe the thrust of the argument that he has made? Again, trying to boil it down to the lowest common denominator, so to speak. All right, and his primary proof was what?
His origins and the oath that God made.
Okay, the priest after the order of Melchizedek, which he kept quoting. He is a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. So that dimension of the Melchizedek priesthood, which suggests the perpetuity or the continuity of his priesthood, and also that it was essential that that be accomplished. Now, he's going to build upon that, and he has just introduced us to at least one dimension of the priesthood of Christ, but he has also alluded to some things that were said at the beginning of the book that lead us into another phase of his argument. Remember, 7, 8, 9, and through verse 18 of chapter 10 is the totality of his argumentation with respect to the high priest of Christ. I realize there are other references to it, but this is the main heart of the argument, is this section. So, it's not just that Christ was a high priest after the order of Melchizedek. Not just that his priesthood is one that's continuous. But in the big scheme of things, what is so significant about Christ, first of all?
Superior.
I'm sorry?
He's superior.
Well, no, but in terms of why he came. Why did he? Well, what's the big deal? Why did he come?
Seek and save the lost.
All right, to seek and save the lost. Fulfill God's plan for the salvation of men's souls. Now, does the high priesthood of Christ have anything to do with that? Or is this just kind of an extra added, little bit of frosting on the cake? Paul?
He had something to offer. He offered himself to sacrifice for our sins.
All right, so it's crucial to the whole concept. Again, it's a package. There are many different facets of it. And this is one facet of it that's being emphasized, but we've got to look at the whole picture. And so with respect to that, the fact of his priesthood, then, as Paul just mentioned, there was something for a priest to do. And that's what priests typically always did, is they offered something that had to do with other people. So you see where he's leading us. He's leading us into an understanding of the importance or the significance of the high priesthood of Christ, because he's already established the fact that he is. But then, you know, the rest of the question is, well, so what? So we're getting into the so what. I mean, not that he hadn't touched on it already, but he's really getting down to the nitty-gritty in terms of the so what. So, the chief point, as he mentions here in verse 1 of chapter 8, is what? Starts out, now the chief point is, or the things which we are saying, the chief point is this. All right, we have a high priest. I'm sorry, Paul, what did you say?
It's the sum of all they've been teaching. Uh-huh. Christ is our high priest. I mean, everything is fulfilled in him.
All right. Okay. And he of course, at the end of chapter 7, when he talked about he offered up himself, he is laying the groundwork for the details that he's going to be bringing out later on in chapters 8 and chapter 9, in particular in chapter 9. And that he was a son perfected forevermore. Again, the son, that term son, the son of God, that's used in the Gospels in particular, was a messianic term. Whenever the Jew heard son of God, they're thinking immediately about the Messiah, which again, the Messiah in his work relates to the scheme of redemption. So we need to understand that this is just more than mere terms. We're dealing with the concept of his role and of his mission and what he accomplished. And in particular, in verse 2, after he addresses the fact that he was at the right hand of God, at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heavens, and we'll come back to that in just a moment, he said he was a minister. So now he introduces us to a term that relates to the priesthood of Christ, and that is a minister. And we'll look at that in just a moment. So I want us to get a feel for the flow. And this, I know the Holy Spirit is the author of the text, but this is one of the things that leads me to the idea, anyway, that the Apostle Paul might well have been the author of this, because it's classic Paul in terms of the statements, the arguments, the supportive material. But, of course, I grant right away we don't know who the author is, and the Holy Spirit could have used somebody else to do the same thing. But it is just a masterpiece of logic. And it well deserves the time that we spend to understand it, not just from the standpoint of its logical argumentation, but of course for the truth that it teaches about Christ. All right, let's back up there to question number 2. I mentioned, alluded to this a moment ago. What is the role of Jesus here that's stressed in the introduction of this section? I understand the high priest, but what else are we reminded of here? It goes back to chapter 1. And I believe Brother Harkrider brought this out in the book. What's this business about sitting down at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heavens? What does that suggest? Kingship. Absolutely. It's kingship. Yeah. That was the preeminent position of one who was sitting, again, at the right hand, which the idea of the right hand being the predominant place, the place of authority of God in this case, which we know that's the way that the Lord was introduced to us at the beginning. Verse 3 of chapter 1, he made purification of sins and sat down on the right hand of the majesty on high. Same terminology. And the made purification of sins, that's a reference to the Jewish understanding of the role of a high priest, particularly as it relates to the Day of Atonement and the work that the priest did. It had to do with the atoning for sins, again, and looking at it from the Jewish perspective now, putting ourselves in their shoes and seeing that the apostle is arguing in response to the Judaizing teachers who are saying, well, the law of Moses did what we needed, and so therefore we don't need anything else. So, what's a minister? He said he's a minister. Anybody do any word studies on that, Sue?
The one I said, it's a public servant. The minister is a public servant.
All right, the root, yeah, the root of it is that exact idea. This is, let me get over here. This is Esword, so it's free. All right. So it's a good place to start in terms of word studies. Right. But you see here, he points out that, well, let me get the right one here. Yeah, here we are, right down here in the dictionary. This is Thayer, okay? And I've also got others up there, wrong one. A public minister or a servant of the state. Well, that would be the secular use of the term. Okay. I'd like for us to take a peek at this one here. Really gives us, I think, a real appreciation for this. Okay, it comes from these Greek words. Liturgia is the noun. By the way, we get an English word from this Greek word that probably a Catholic would immediately relate to, but also some other denominations. Liturgy. Okay. What I wanted to get over here to, along with the usage in a predominantly public sense in reference to, again, taxes, general service, et cetera, okay, he points out that in the Septuagint, that's what LXX abbreviates, the Septuagint, which was the Greek translation of the Old Testament, it was pretty much the it appears to be, for the most part, the version of the Old Testament that was in common usage at the time of Christ, because it was translated, 200 plus years earlier in Alexandria. It is a reference to the temple service and the priest and the Levites, and it most often renders these Hebrew terms, Sirid or Bodo, where these terms are used again in reference to the work of the priest. So, to the Jew, when they heard this word in the Greek, they would immediately think about the service of the priest, the work of the priest, and the role of the priest under Judaism. So that really, I think, amplifies our appreciation for the argument that the apostle is making, because he's saying this is what Christ does. And there, in the Judaizing teacher and in the Jewish background, in that person's mind, oh no, that was what the Levitical priest did. But here he's saying, no, this is what Christ does. Okay? It seemed like there was... In the New Testament, there are references, again, to the ministry in the temple. But in particular, you find the most frequent usage of it in the book of Hebrews, okay, in terms of the work that's done in the sanctuary, which we'll get to also down in verse 6 there in just a moment. And then he makes this observation: consistent with the new covenant, it represents superior worship. So, in their mind, they would be connecting the idea of worship and service and the work of the priest. They would have that all together in their mind. So, looking at this rough attempt to try to relate these terms in this way, like I've been doing, here we've got the reference to Christ, the high priest. He has taken his seat, okay, where he ministers in the sanctuary, in the true tabernacle set up by the Lord and not by man. Now here is a very emphatic declaration on the part of the apostle, in the contrast between where the Levitical priests do their work and where the high priest after the order of Melchizedek, which is Jesus, is. And that is, he is where the true tabernacle is. And he calls that a sanctuary. Again, in the Jewish mind, the place of worship. But the Levitical priests did theirs in an earthly tabernacle or corresponding place. And this one in the true tabernacle. And who is it that erected the true tabernacle? God. Exactly. We understand we're dealing with metaphorical language. He's not talking about a tent that's somewhere way out in outer space. When tabernacle, we think of the tent. It's a movable structure. This is a figure of speech. So it's figurative language. But, again, trying to get them to understand and get the picture in their mind, he's contrasting that which is true versus the opposite of that. Now, I've mentioned several times that the word true in English comes from one of two Greek words. One has to do with the opposite of false. You remember what the other one? Genuine, real. That's this one. This is the genuine or real tabernacle versus the other one. Now, he's going to, down in verse 5, of course, he's going to talk about copies and shadows. Remember when we introduced the whole book of Hebrews, we talked about the type-shadow relationship. You've got the shadow, and then you got the type, which is the real deal. I would like to think that I was a shadow of my former self, but it's not working out that way. It seems to be going in the other direction. But, we know the difference between the real thing and a shadow. So everything under the old system is characterized as a type, a copy, a shadow, et cetera, et cetera. As opposed to what is the real substance of all of these things. And it's the contrast between the physical and the spiritual. But we know how the Jew was hung up on the physical. His physical lineage, the physical place of worship, and the physical priesthood, and all of those things. That was really what had captured their affection and their attention. So the task of the apostle here is to try to counter that and get them over into their mind, over into the spiritual domain, and thinking about it from that standpoint. And so he uses terms like this, which really should, I mean, to them, it really would make a difference, you know, to talk about the true tabernacle and not the one set up by man. Well, which one would that be? Well, yeah, the Holy of Holies was in there. The one back in the wilderness. That's where it all started out, wasn't it? Is whenever God gave the instructions to Moses and with respect to the tabernacle and all the furniture, and he's going to, of course, get into that in chapter 9 and all some of the service that was in that tabernacle. And so you've got what was set up by the Lord and, in contrast, what was set up by man. And, of course, what was set up by the Lord, this is the truth. This has to do with the high priest and, of course, the one who is in heaven as opposed to what takes place on earth. But you've got several different points of contrast here. You know, heaven, earth, the tabernacle set up by God, the one set up by man, and the true versus the shadow or the copy that we'll see down here in just a minute. So he's coming at it from a lot of different directions. Again, just hammering away. It sounds like it's a broken record, but that's sometimes what it takes, is repetition. And it's, you know, it's kind of like when you're looking at a, you know, an object that has multi sides, many sides to it or whatever, you turn it around, you look. You know, if you were buying a vase, I'd call it a vase, but I guess if it's really important, it's a vase. Huh? And there was it was something that was supposed to be really special, you wouldn't just look at one side of it. You know, you'd turn it around, you'd look at top, bottom, I mean, you'd look at every little nook and cranny, and you know, if your eye was educated, you'd really look at it very carefully. Well, that's what he's doing with the high priesthood of Christ. He's looking at it from all these different perspectives and angles, and looking at it very carefully and dissecting it almost down to the minutest point for their benefit and hopefully for ours. Through verse 2, does anyone have any questions to this point? Or comments?
When Moses got the law, it was 1,400 years or so in that area. Those Jews were so steeped in their religion, you can see how difficult it was for them to steer away from it.
Absolutely.
They felt that God was in the temple and the whole thing, and they were told that they were God's people, whether they were, you know, good relationship or not with him, they still always felt that they were God's people.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's just like religion today, trying to get somebody to steer from a denomination to another religion. It difficult for people.
It, you know, and like you say, the more ingrained it is in their being and how all of the 1,500 years of baggage that they're carrying with them, the harder it is to turn loose of it. So you're right. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Anything else? Now, verse 3, every high priest is appointed for the purpose of offering gifts and sacrifices. Well, yeah, that's basically what they do. Okay, that's what the high priest did. That's what he said back there in chapter 5, verse 1. You know, every high priest being taken from among men is appointed for men in things pertaining to God, that he may offer both gifts and sacrifices for sins. So, the idea of the high priest doing this because of people's sins, if they were persuaded that the mission was accomplished, you can understand, it kind of goes back to Richard's point a moment ago, you can understand why they would see absolutely no need for another high priest. Because as far as they were concerned, the one that, you know, the system that they were under and what the high priest did on the Day of Atonement took care of it. So, yeah, that. And he alludes to the fact that, yes, and we'll talk about Leviticus 16 eventually. But that's exactly what their understanding of the work of the priest was. So, to offer gifts and sacrifices. Now, and if that's what they're supposed to do, then they've got to have something to offer. But now he comes back to this point that he brought up in chapter 7, and that is that if he, of course, this is Jesus, the high priest, after the order of Melchizedek, if he was still on the earth, he would not be a priest. Now, what did he say about that in chapter 7? What proof did he offer that this could not be possible? Wrong tribe. All right, that's one of the main arguments that he made, is that he is not of the correct tribe. Okay. Now, he's also, and I mentioned this just a moment ago, and it's been mentioned several times, so we won't spend too much time on it, that what he had to offer was himself. You know, he said that back there in chapter 7. This verse 27, this he did once for all when he offered up himself. And so he has already introduced the idea of the fact that what Christ did was to offer himself. Now, he's not going to get into the real, all of the details of how this fit into God's plan until chapter 9. He's going to hit the high point, or just kind of hit some high points here, but especially when we get over to chapter 9, middle part of the chapter, he's really going to come down hard and heavy on that. But just at this point, if again making comparisons between the Levitical system and what he's said at this point about the sacrifice of Christ, what's the difference? What did the high priest offer? Animals. Right, animals. And blood, bulls and goats, as he mentions in chapter 10, verse 4. So you've got a huge difference here, a disparity between, again, showing that these two priesthoods, the Levitical system versus the priesthood of Christ, are they're miles apart. And this is another dimension of that, is that they offer the things that were specified under the law versus the fact that Jesus offered himself. Okay. And they were priests offering the gifts as the law directed. Now, you see, this is kind of subtle. But he's just painted a picture here of the big difference between what the priest offered under the old law and what Christ offered. And then he throws this in, and those offerings, those gifts and offerings, were according to the law. So now what does that say about the law? It must, all right, it's a shadow. It must be inferior. There must be some significant differences here. Inferior versus superior. And of course, now, he's, pretty soon, when we get over to verse 8, he's going to bring the whole thing together when he quotes from Jeremiah chapter 31. But you see how he brings these points in as he goes along in his arguments? It's just so... It's really interesting when you look at it and see how he builds his argument. and then this this statement here, which appears to be parenthetical. These priests, it is true, are engaged in a service which is only a copy and a shadow of heavenly realities. Well, he talked about the true tabernacle, the genuine tabernacle, and of course he's already talked about service, so since these priests are the ones that are engaged in that, then now he brings in this terminology of the copy or the shadow. And again, the comparison is between the real deal, the heavenly realities, according to this term, and the copy and the shadow, which is what these guys are doing. So, again, the type-shadow relationship, copy-shadow, the substance in the shadow. And, again, that this is shown by the direction Moses directions given to Moses when he was about to construct the tabernacle. Well, this tabernacle is the one that relates to this over here. Remember, he talked about the true tabernacle earlier. Now, we've got the tabernacle that Moses built, but that's part of this copy and shadow domain. And he said, then look to it, are the words that thou make every part in accordance with the pattern shown thee on the mountain. Now, I'll tuck this in here. I thought I'd put my initials there. I added this, trying to get the flow of the argument in our mind. Well, God said this about that. What we have now is an argument from the lesser to the greater. If this is true, and this is what God did, and he did, and what he said about this over here is the lesser, then if you shift from the lesser to the greater, then what's the point about the greater as it relates to the lesser? Are you confused? Okay, again, this is classic argument, lesser to greater. If this is true about the lesser, that is, if God said this, for these priests to do this about that which is a shadow, well, what do you think we need to pay attention to about that which is not the shadow but is the true or the reality? Absolutely. And so if you're going to say, hey, we ought to do this, and those that are, again, buying into the Levitical system as the thing to do, well, if God said this about that, and he's already laid the groundwork. That was done away with. That was just a preliminary part of God's plan. If you're going to buy into this over here, then you ought to buy into this over here without a hesitation. Because the same God that said that said this. And but Jesus, as we see, has obtained a ministry far exceeding theirs. So now he's come to the greater. Okay, the lesser, the greater. And he's already told us about the fact that he's a minister. of the true tabernacle, in the true tabernacle, in the heaven, where the heavenly realities are, according to this version. And so he has laid out the line of reasoning, and now he's coming down to the application of it to Christ as the high priest. But Jesus, as we see, has obtained a ministry far excelling theirs, as the covenant of which he is the intermediary or mediator, based as it is on better promises, excels the former covenant. So this one is so far superior because it relates to these heavenly realities versus the shadow. The former covenant, which is the shadow that pertains to the work that the priests do under the law. You've got the law, you've got their work, you've got the priesthood itself. All on one side of the picture, and on the other side you've got that which pertains to the heavenly realities. Jesus, whose ministry far exceeds theirs, and not only that, it's based upon a covenant which he is the mediator. What is a you've got one definition of mediator right there, don't you? What is a mediator? What does a mediator do? Well, hopefully, but it's a little simpler than that.
It's an objective arbiter.
Okay. Which means there's two sides, right? And he's in between. That's literally what the main term means. It means to bridge the gap. So you've got the issue, you've got the issue over here, so he's gonna stand in the middle here, and he's gonna bring these two sides together. That's what Jesus does as mediator. He brings the two sides together. Colossians 1 verse 20. Reconciliation of... boy. That forgetter is... I bet I've quoted that verse 1,000 times. And through him to reconcile all things to himself, having made peace through the blood of his cross. Through him, I say, whether things upon the earth or things in the heaven. Reconciliation. To reconcile is to bring into agreement. That's what, back in the olden days, we used to do with our bank statements. And in fact, mine still, on the back of it, still has the old reconciliation form. You bring the bank account's numbers into agreement with your checkbook, hopefully. Reconciling. Bringing into agreement. That's what Christ does as a mediator. Is he facilitates this reconciliation through the fact that he offered himself, or as Colossians 1:20 says, the blood of his cross. It's all part of the whole system of the scheme of redemption. Now, bring that into this equation, and you see again this dramatic contrast between what those were doing under that former covenant, the copy and the shadow, the priest offering those gifts and sacrifices versus his, because not only is it a ministry far superior, but he is the mediator, the intermediary, which again in this whole context, that means his mediatorship has to fall into this spectrum right here, the one of the real mediator. The one that's really going to get the job done. And of course, again, I'm jumping ahead and I keep going over there, but it's key to this whole section, and that's Hebrews 9:15, and that is that both in the old and the new, particularly as it relates to the old and all that these things were done, the only way that those people could have ever been reconciled to God is through what Christ accomplished in their obedience to God, but it was absolutely impossible for it to have been done by the blood of bulls and goats. Hebrews 10 verse 4, it required the sacrifice of Christ, which makes him the superior intermediary, the superior mediator. I mean, light years difference. We're talking daylight and dark difference. Well, this is just, that's rich. the way the Holy Spirit laid all that out. And I'm talking to a friend of mine who I consider to be one of the most adept arguers when it comes to Scripture. And he said he just gets goosebumps every time he reads this section here because it's just such a, it is the most masterful presentation of evidence that's that he believes that's in any book in the Bible. I mean, not that there's not other places where you don't have it, but this one is just so significant and carefully spelled out. Questions or comments or observations?
The Jews ignored their own prophets, the scripture that was leading up to to Jesus. And here it is 2,000 years later, it's over 2,000 years, and they still don't believe it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we still got a nation.
Right.
That are unbelievers.
Oh yeah, and of course he's really going to jump on that when he gets over here to dealing with with the Jeremiah chapter 31. When he talks about what Jeremiah said about all that he's been talking about here.
I don't know what it would take to change their mind. Somebody walking on water, I think.
Well, we've got a record of that happening. That impacted some people. Now, in verse 5 here, he refers to this warning that God gave, going all the way back to what he said to Moses. Again, you think about it from the standpoint of the argument of the lesser to the greater. What did God warn Moses about when he gave him the instructions for that whole tabernacle? Make it according to the pattern. All right, if we're gonna keep the point of emphasis, well, if that old shadowy thing was supposed to be made according to the pattern, where do you think God's attitude is toward the type? Should the pattern be followed?
Yes.
Of course. Do we have any evidence that people kind of blow that off? Can you think of any examples? I'm talking about today, 1988 or whatever year this is. Mm-hmm. So we can point our finger at the denominations. Oh, wait a minute. Do we have any of that problem among our brethren?
Yes, we do.
It never ends. I was listening to a lectureship at Freed Hardeman. I think it was 2010 or 11. The lectureship at Freed Hardeman, the whole thing was about, quote, patternism. Patternism. And it's that new hermeneutic that, hey, these things were said back then, but they don't really apply to us. Yeah, they were supposed to follow pattern, but, you know, not now. No pattern, no real patterns. And that's why guys like Rubel Shelley and, a lot of those fellows have gone. I mean, I've got a little booklet that Rubel Shelley wrote on authority that's probably, it was written in the 70s. Okay. I mean, and he lays it out four square. You know, here's what God says, here's what we're supposed to do. And now you know where Rubel Shelley is, besides Tennessee, in terms of that? does he still acknowledge or espouse that people need to believe in Jesus?
Last I read, he did.
That's the last I read that he did, but that's as far as he went. Now, he went from it, you know, in 30-plus years or so, he went from saying, yes, we need to follow the pattern, so to speak, and here it is, to all you need to do is believe in Jesus. Now, he's not by himself. In fact, he's probably representative of the maybe a majority of where churches have gone in the last 30 years.
Paul? I have a question about this. When he's talking here, he's a mediator of a better covenant. He's that go-between the old covenant and the new covenant. You're not talking about mediator between man and God, right?
Well, I don't understand it that way. I think he's talking about his role. Again, he's comparing the two kinds of mediators. The Old Testament, the Jewish Levitical mediator, which in their mind, that's what the priest was, versus the high priest after the order of Melchizedek, which is a superior mediator because it's a superior covenant. That's the conclusion I've come to. Cameron?
I think it, all the references you just went over, the people you mentioned, because of my age maybe, but I think it's interesting, or not so much, I think you have to be careful almost with the idea of, you have to be more specific, I think, when you talk about patterns.
Oh, yeah.
Because clearly, there's a difference between moral law, which we find in the Old Testament, which is still binding. The things that God found disgusting and awful and abominable back then, he still does. It's not like he changes his mind.
Right.
But at the same time, it's not like, I mean, we don't worship it. The things that were the pattern for the nation of Israel are not things that we do today because we have this better covenant. So I think I can imagine people hearing the use of that term and kind of seeing it or being confused by it. So
well, right, and then they're going to jump on the legalistic bandwagon and say, well, all you're doing is just saying there's a bunch of rules to keep. And that, I was hopeful that the people that are in the room tonight wouldn't see it that from that perspective. But, yeah, you're absolutely right. We have to be real careful. And so depending on the hearers, I try to make a distinction. But you're right on. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it's not about keeping rules. And, of course, you haven't been around very long, but I've preached on that several times, many times. I bring that out. Which doesn't mean there's not something for us to do. It just means that it's not merely a matter of rule keeping. It's doing what God says. That applies to us. And I see that as the point that he's making here, and that is, okay, if God wanted them to do what I said as it relates to that system, then when he talks about this new covenant, the superior, the one that's exceedingly superior, don't you figure he's going to want us to do that too? Well, of course he is. And when you get to the end of chapter 7, he really pounds on that. I mean, chapter 10, I'm sorry. When you get to the end of chapter 10, he really brings that home because he says our God is a consuming fire and therefore we ought to render service to him. And in the context of that, his point is if we don't, we're toast. Do what he says. Matthew 7:21 and following. But don't do it just because you're keeping a set of rules. No way, Jose. I know our time is up. So, Lord willing, we will proceed from that point, and I suspect that we'll probably get into chapter 9 next week. So be sure you have picked up your question sheet that some people asked for. if you haven't already.